There's a wondrous sense of vitality and kind, caring attention here in your center of practice. Congratulations. I realized when I came in here today and met with Gil that I had been here before, many years ago, when it was a Unity Church. Co-practitioner friend Mary Lee Revels, the minister of the Unity Church, invited my husband Arnie Kotler and me to give a day of mindfulness here. So that was quite a wonderful realization that you are now here. And the place has such a good feeling. Today is the day. Today is the day that used to be called Armistice Day. Well, this is the holiday to mark the 11th day of the 11th month. Armistice Day. Originally, you know, the commemoration of the end of the war to end all wars. Only it didn't really turn out to be that way. And the name was changed to Veterans Day. Because, of course, there was another world war and so on. I came out from the island of Maui to join Maxine on Kingston and my Dharma colleague Wendy Johnson. And this past weekend, we had a meditation and writing retreat with veterans of the Korean War and the Vietnam War at the Quaker Center in Ben Lomond, in the Redwoods. We gathered in a pentagonal building. And because of that, we modeled the, you know, our arrangement in accord with the shape of the building. So there were two concentric circles. And it was very, very strong support. Two concentric circles facing each other, surrounded by a redwood forest with many circles of redwood families. Very supportive environment for first time meditators healing the wounds of war. We were guided by Maxine in writing exercises to inhale, to breathe in and be inspired, to breathe and tell the truth. Exercises to tell that which has never been told before. Much work to unpack the feelings encountered through the experience of war. For combat veterans, medics, nurses, family members of veterans, and resource people working with veterans. And at some point we had the discussion, well, should we be having this some other weekend? You know, so that veterans won't be torn between coming to the retreat and protesting and having their voices heard in important ways. And there was a strong consensus. This is exactly what we belong doing on Veterans Day weekend. The art of peacemaking, which is full of non-peace elements. And so tonight, very briefly, alas, I would like to offer some supplemental teachings on being with feelings. I know you have very rich and full teachings here. I was a little perplexed when I started studying the sutra on the four establishments of mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutta, Satipatthana Sutra. When in the section about feelings, you know, there were long descriptions about sorting out the beans and the seeds, the sacks of beans and seeds and so on. Well, I got the drift. And then with Thich Nhat Hanh, in teachings that are gathered together in the book Peace is Every Step, there's a very succinct section on being with feelings. And we had many sessions of practice with those teachings, recognizing feelings. Sound familiar? Embracing feelings. You know, the image of holding feelings like the crying baby. Not judging, not criticizing, but receiving, embracing, and calming the feelings. And I always remember my colicky niece. We would hold her like this and rock her. Sometimes it takes that kind of holding. Strong holding, strong agitating feelings, hard to calm feelings. Got to move with them, not be too constricted about them, not too demanding, be receptive. And I am so grateful to this woman, Miriam Greenspan, for her teachings. It took 10 years for her to put together these teachings, healing through the dark emotions, the wisdom of grief, fear, and despair. And I want to touch on these in relation to the practice of mindfulness of feelings and mindfulness of the mind, states of mind, mental formations. And by the way, she's a Vipassana practitioner who's been a psychotherapist for 30 years. She boils this practice down to three basic practices. Attending to, befriending, and surrendering to. Easy to remember. Befriending, not pushing away. Befriending. She has very handy sayings. You have to feel it in order to heal it. She was trying to find her own balance with the strong teaching she received, especially from some visiting Asian teachers who were very fierce about letting go of feelings. As a Western woman, she needed to find the right balance between being with and letting go. She's very wary, as many of us are at times, of a certain tendency to do what amounts to a kind of spiritual or emotional bypass. Especially with all the inclination in our society demonstrated in that telling moment. Remember years ago when the Olympic ice skater was violently injured by someone in a very, well, dubious way. And very quickly, she was telling herself, which was reflecting so much in our culture, I've got to get over it. I've got to get past it. I mean, within less than a month, people who, after 3 months of grieving the loss of a parent or a child, are told to get on with their life. This is what is termed, emotion phobia. I'm glad to hear the term. It helps give us a handle on this tendency. It gives us a handle. So this seven-step practice of emotional alchemy starts with intention, a focusing spiritual will. And for me, this comes down to making the determination. And sometimes I have to wake up and say it to myself right away. I am determined to learn from this suffering. I am determined to learn from you, most painful, dark, as in no light on it, no seeing, unbearable to look. Nobody wants to see it. That kind of dark. I'm going to learn from you. I'm going to look at you. Intention. I will shed light on you. Very strengthening and helps us stay in the room. Tell me it's going to be all right, my loved ones. Co-workers kept saying while he was lying there in a coma. It was unbearable to see him so different from how we had all known him. And it was unbearable to think of him never being that way again. And I knew from sitting in the room with him, I knew from sitting in the zendo with myself, that it was beautiful. He was breathing. And I was going to stand by him and take care of him and see how he unfolded, and see how my feelings unfolded. And I did lots of walking meditation there in the room and out in the hall, careful to stay out of the way of the rushing medical people. What a comfort and what a support practice can be. Being with the difficult, the seemingly unbearable feelings. And this practice of affirmation, developing an emotion-friendly attitude. This is really helpful with the inmates at Maui Community Correctional Center. Sometimes the hour and a half that we have together every week is the only time they can let down their defenses and feel those unbearable feelings of loss, of years lost with their children, the years lost in fogs of violence. And addiction. Yeah, looking at feelings and feelings takes courage and it gives strength. And the beautiful and very handy practice of bodily sensations, noticing bodily sensations. And Miriam describes three steps: sensing, soothing, and naming. Very familiar, I'm sure. How wonderful that the body doesn't lie. I thought I was dealing so well with stress and difficult feelings, alienation, estrangement, loneliness, sheer fatigue. I thought I was dealing with it pretty well, getting enough sleep and so on. And there come the shingles to call me to look again, to feel again. Very humbling. Humbling in the sense of humus. Granted, I've just been hiking up these steep paths in the redwood forest, practically crawling up those trails. So, humble has a very invigorating sense for me now, but still difficult to have the shingles on my crown, no less. You know, or you think you're holding it together and in a conversation with someone, and you notice your knees are shaking. You know, this practice is not to ignore the knees. In fact, that's a beautiful bell of mindfulness. Listen. This important feeling is calling me back to my true home, being with the feeling, learning from the feeling. Fourth practice is, she calls, contextualization. And here she talks a lot about our core defect story. which usually is very absolute and very limited. And she is suggesting that we beware of this. Notice it. Again, a bell of mindfulness, calling us to re-examine it and open it up. Recontextualize in the broadest way. Recontextualize our personal story, you know, in its broader social, cultural, and global context. It's really exploring the truth of our feeling most widely. This is very freeing. This is the fifth practice is one that I think we as meditators are pretty familiar with. She calls it the way of non-action. You know, it's all the hours we spend sitting still, being aware, not moving. It's refraining from speech that is not right, as in complete. The way of non-action. And the sixth practice is the way of action, spiritual service. It was very important, you know, we just published a book of the Veterans Writers, the Veterans Writers Group. And it's called Veterans of War, Veterans of Peace. And some of the writers worked on their piece for more than 10 years, literally the same piece. They went all over the map with it and got down to the most essential words, you know, certain poems and certain short stories. Some 80 writers. It was very important when it came to the time to decide, well, how do we distribute the royalties to 80 writers? And the people had a discussion about giving the proceeds, dividing up the proceeds and giving them to certain projects. Some of the proceeds go to Code Pink. Some go to the Dove Fund. Some to East West Foundation. And some to Montagnard Vinson Monastery. So here are veterans, many of whom fought in the war in Vietnam and destroyed villages, schools, medical facilities, and many, many injuries. And now schools are being built, medical facilities are being built. Redemptive. And this is enabling the veterans to acknowledge their suffering in the process of transformation of that suffering. And the last practice is so beautiful and rich. And it was also there in, it is also there in Thich Nhat Hanh's teachings. But Miriam really fleshes it out. The practice of transformation. She calls it the way of surrender. I want to read a section. The art of conscious emotional flow is the art of surrender. Emotional flow is not something you find by sitting down and thinking about your feelings a lot, or analyzing how you got to be the way you are, which is why years and years of talk therapy often create little emotional change. This is a psychotherapist. Emotional flow has its source not in the talking, analyzing part of the brain, but in the intuitive, creative part. Emotional energy in a state of flow moves automatically in the direction of healing, renewal, harmony, and transformation. This is a mantra. Emotional energy in a state of flow moves automatically in the direction of healing, renewal, harmony, and transformation. I mean, do you hear that? Beauty and relief. This step can be cultivated through creativity, prayer, energy work, and play. And there are many chapters here. And this is on just three emotions: grief, fear, and despair. Ultimately, the way of surrender brings us to the emotional skill of making new meaning out of our suffering. This quintessentially human ability to create new meaning out of emotional pain allows us to heal from the past and transform the present. I saw this weekend, just yesterday, on Veterans Day proper, when at 11 minutes after the 11th hour, we had a ritual by the mistress of ritual, Wendy Johnson, an altar with 11 candles and a bell rung 11 times by the veterans and the people working with veterans, including a young woman in Philadelphia working with Iraq veterans of war in writing and meditation workshops. And lighting a candle, ringing the bell, standing there in the middle of the concentric circles in the middle of the redwood forest, the veterans were honored, they were recognized. There was space for many feelings, not just heroism, which is important, the heroic deeds done, but the vulnerability, the loss, the fear, the despair. And each person spoke from the place they were at with lots of encouragement to carry on the healing, the individual healing, societal healing, world healing. There's time, I think, it's 10 of, for any questions or responses. Yes.
About your work in the Maui Correctional Facility. A couple of months ago, we had a wonderful talk about the cultivation of happiness, and it's natural to think that a lot of that time would be in feeling and contemplating loss, but in especially that situation, the cultivation of joy and happiness is absolutely essential, critical. So how does that happen?
How does it happen for inmates? Yeah, you know, it's usually a few women at a time that I work with. And one of the young women, I mean, most of the women I work with are in their 20s, and they have children. And I think for this woman who, you know, whose life was taken over by addiction to ice, that is the epidemic on Maui, on all the Hawaiian islands, these years. It's very difficult for her to even think of her daughter, because the shame and the loss and the fear are so great. So I know how important it is to balance, you know, sukha and dukkha, awareness of sukha and dukkha. So after we have some sitting meditation, and it's never 40 minutes, but over many months it might get up to 20 or 25 minutes. At first, it's maybe 5 or 10 minutes. 10 minutes can be a long time. After some sitting, and especially some walking, because it's almost always easier for these women to ground themselves in the present moment and to feel stabilized through walking meditation. You know, in, out, calm, ease. Then to have some Dharma discussion, including, you know, hearing her count the ways she remembers her daughter, because she hasn't seen her daughter in such a long time, years. And the mother-in-law may never let her see her. It depends. So, you know, to remember. And often then the tears come. And always coming back to, you can do this for your daughter. You can live in this way for your daughter. Practice for your daughter. Just as I was instructed, do walking meditation for the one who cannot walk. Very important to incubate these practices. Just thinking about them or being inspired by them is not enough, especially when, you know, we are pulled out away from our center. When this woman got out of prison, she couldn't sit at all. We only did walking meditation. We'll see what happens when I go back. Is there time for one more?
Sure. Could I ask? next one?
Yes.
You said something about the story of our defect. And then that was in the time when you were talking about contextualizing it. And I wonder if you could give an explanation of, maybe you could make it up, but a story of a defect, and then how you would broaden it out to the whole world.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, cuts close to the bone. I was thinking to just read what Miriam says. And yet if I think of, and then I thought, no, go there, say something about my core defect story. But you know what, I don't think there's really time. Honestly. But just think of a way that we tell ourselves, oh, you know, this is the core pain of my life. And this is what it is or why it is. And there's not much space around that story. It's, you know, as she said, these core defect stories, as she's defining it, tend to be very absolute. You know, this is my pain because I am this way, or he or she is that way in relation to me, and so on. And it's very ingrown and limiting, constricting. And to look at it again and again and see it from different perspectives and see the context in which this suffering arose. It's really saying, look at the causes and conditions. You know, the second noble truth, really look at all the causes and conditions. Don't limit it just to your personality or my family or your community or my society. You see, is that clear? We could have a whole weekend on our practice of wider, broader contextualization of our core defect story that imprisons us and doesn't allow us true wisdom, understanding, you know, liberation. Thank you. I knew we didn't have enough time and we still don't. I know you are very good about ending on time. So I'm with you.